I call to order the House Committee on Environment and Land Use. It is 8:36 a.m., and we are going to start off by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2614. And we have Randy Tucker. Morning, Randy.
Good morning.
Get to start things off this morning.
I walked all the way to the back of the room. I should have just hung out up here. Good morning. For the record, my name is Randy Tucker, and I am Legislative Affairs Director with 1,000 Friends of Oregon.
And, Randy, before I have you begin, yeah. I should have the administrator read the bill.
Thank you.
I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2614 clarifies that local governments shall provide in comprehensive or regional plans sufficient buildable lands within urban growth boundaries, and it changes the buildable lands requirement within urban growth boundaries from 20 years time certain for up to 20 years. Slight difference, and this applies to cities over 25,000 in population, Mr. Chair.
Which I think we determined to be about 12. There were 12 cities in the state.
I didn't count this morning, but my staff attorney, Mary Kyle McCurdy, says about 12. I thought I had some recollection as 15 or 16, but anyway, it's no more than that.
Okay, Randy, now you can start all over.
Great. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2614. As Ray mentioned, this makes a small but important change in existing statute, and you should have before you, by the way, some testimony from my colleague, Mary Kyle McCurdy, who is our staff attorney in this matter but couldn't be here this morning. The current law requires that urban growth boundaries for cities of over 25,000 and the cities in metro as a unit have a 20-year supply of land for residential uses. And I should note that the law was changed last session to ease this requirement slightly. It used to be that this requirement also applied to fast-growing cities of under 25,000, cities that had grown at faster, I believe, than the statewide average for three of the preceding 5 years. That was problematic for a couple of reasons. One is that the list changed every year depending on the growth rate of the city and the state. Also that we feel that it's not absolutely necessary to apply it to those smaller cities. So House Bill 2614 would make that up to a 20-year supply. In practice, of course, most cities, especially large cities, do provide for a 20-year land supply for residential uses, but prior to the 95 session, when this requirement went into effect as a part of House Bill 2709, cities were only required by statute to have a long-term supply of land, of residential land, inside UGBs. And as I'm not sure if we've discussed yet in this committee, but is under discussion elsewhere in the legislature, there is in rule a requirement for a 20-year supply of employment land already. At any rate, the flexibility that's allowed us to take into account certain unusual circumstances or unique circumstances of different cities was lost in the passage of House Bill 2709. It hasn't been a crisis, but we believe this is a good step to add that flexibility back in. There, you can conceive of several different circumstances where it might not make sense to have an absolute requirement for 20-year supply of residential land, including circumstances where there might be a neighboring city that could accommodate some of the regional growth and other circumstances. So we would support this bill. It's a modest change, but one that we would urge you to enact.
Any questions of Mr. Tucker? Seeing none, thank you, Randy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Don Schellenberg.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. The Oregon Farm Bureau is here today in support of House Bill 2614. Oregon's land use planning program contains numerous goals. I think there's 19 of them at last count. One of those goals is Goal 3, which is the farmland goal. And then there's other goals, including the urban development goal. That's why we have the Land Conservation and Development Commission. We've got those two goals that they're trying to achieve. The land use laws were doing a fair job of conserving the farmland, and development was proceeding in the urban growth areas, increasing as time went on. However, a change in the status occurred in the mid-90s that placed the emphasis of the land use planning system on development. House Bill 2709 instituted the requirement that cities over 25,000 population, and at the time, as Mr. Tucker said, there was the provision for fast-growing cities as well, which, as he indicated, has been since amended. But it would require that a city forever have 20-year land supply. Well, if you take that to its logical conclusion, of course, in the end, you're going to pave over the whole state if time lasts long enough under that scenario. Well, since then, there have been numerous attempts to amend the language to include the same 20-year requirement for other classes of development. In 2001 session, it was industrial land, commercial, and retail that was part of another bill. There are a couple of bills this session that would specifically target high-tech land. And who knows what particular class is going to be targeted next. We're concerned that in the agriculture community, we may soon have to have a 20-year supply of land for agriculture purposes at the rate things are going. Changes in the law prompted the immediate past director of DLCD to make the comment that today we don't have a farmland protection program, we have a farmland conversion program. And with the required minimum 20-year supply, that would be the case. The truth is, Oregon's Willamette Valley is blessed with the richest soil in the world and near ideal growing conditions for upwards of 200 different commodities. And at least 7 out of the top 10 agriculture-producing counties in the state are located in the Willamette Valley. In addition, The manicured open spaces provided by agriculture producers and the renewable natural resources industries that are here are an economic stabilizing force in the state. Imagine what an economic disaster Oregon would be in if we depended entirely on the high-tech industry. So just an argument for a diversified economy in the state of Oregon and agriculture, your natural resource industry industries, including forestry, the renewable ones are—they're there. They don't go away. They don't just because times get bad. They don't pick up and leave the state. They're constant, and so they provide that good source of stability. And yes, the industry has been a positive economic factor for Oregon for some years, but it's not, of course, the sole answer to Oregon's economy. Agriculture has seen a steady increase in its farm gate sales over the years, hitting an all-time high in 2001 of over $3.4 billion farm gate value. The sad fact was that the beauty, climate, and opportunities of the valley also draw a significant number of people to vie for ownership of that same excellent farmland. And while cities want to expand to accommodate the demand for residences, study after study show that from a tax standpoint, expansion is a losing proposition. For every dollar of property tax paid by the rural property owners, the rural property owners receive about 50 cents of services for every dollar they pay in property taxes, whereas in the city, the city spend about a dollar and a half for property services for every dollar that they receive in property taxes. Meanwhile, we have significant portions of lesser quality land in other parts of the state that could sustain an increased population. In fact, population is needed in some areas to justify some of their social and commercial services, such as schools, local government, and businesses. We probably could have made a better decision, or maybe would have made a better decision for Oregon with House Bill 2709 if the 20-year buildable requirement had been applied only outside the Willamette Valley. but we didn't do it that way. But and maybe it's still a good idea today. Maybe that's the kind of change we need to make. I say all of this to make the point that the passage of House Bill 2614 is at least a step in the right direction. It simply gives local government the option to choose not to expand onto the best farmland, and it gives them the option to not spend more money on services than they get in revenue. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Oregon Farm Bureau supports the passage of House Bill 2614 and recommends that you send it out of committee for the due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Shelton? Seeing none, thank you, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have no one else signed up. Is there anyone else who would like to speak, cities? Ms. Ludwig, would you like to come forward? Oh, well, he just lucked out then, Harlan. We were going to do Beauty and the Beast thing, but... you're no beast, Harlan, are you? I apologize for
that. Certainly no beauty.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sorry about being tardy this morning. I've got a one-month-old at home, and it was an adventure this morning. I don't need to go into the graphic details. Anyway, for the record, my name is Harlan Levy, staff attorney for the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'm here to testify against House Bill 2614. We are concerned that the bill, because it removes the requirement for a 20-year supply of buildable land in Oregon's larger cities, it will have a very detrimental effect on housing affordability across the state. Oregon already suffers from one of the least affordable housing markets in the nation. I saw some statistics the other day, as a matter of fact. I'll give you an example. The Portland metropolitan region, out of 186 cities on the list of Housing Affordability Index, which is a list created by the National Home Builders Association, and it takes into effect not only mean house price, but also the average income of the citizens, the inhabitants of those cities. Of the 186 cities on the list, Portland ranked about 170th for the nation in terms of affordability. Oregon also is one of the few states in the nation that is bucking the majority and is actually seeing a decrease in home ownership over the past 10 years. I saw a statistic just the other day that said that Oregon was, out of 50 states, 41st in terms of the percentage of people that own their own home. That is unacceptable. The numbers are even worse when you consider minorities and lower income individuals. So we are concerned that this bill will create additional shortages of housing across the state, and we would ask that this committee not accept this bill, reject it. With that, I will conclude my testimony, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Representative Greenwood.
Good morning. I commiserate with you on the adventures of parenthood. It gets better when they're grandchildren.
The chair would agree to that.
You start with the assertion that this will raise the cost of housing, and even though we've had 20 years supply, you then say this is the most expensive. So the way we've been doing it has made us the most expensive in the country. I wonder if you could work through that assertion and to maybe provide some evidence or provide a model that would explain how changing the words 20 years to up to 20 years automatically raises the price of housing in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleck, when you have a constrained supply of housing, complaint supply of land in which you can build housing, it's going to drive the market price up. That is simple economics. This bill, as I read it, allows a city to, for example, have a six-month supply of buildable land, would comply with this bill, and they would be in compliance with the statutes that require housing. A six-month supply of buildable land is going to create exorbitant prices for those houses that are already on the market. I mean, it's great for those people that are, you know, selling their homes, because they would see an incredible rise in the value of their home for purposes of selling. It's those people that are trying to get into the market that we are most concerned about. What you'd be doing, we already have a very expensive, the reason, and you know, there is, it is open to debate, I will admit, why Oregon has such a problem with housing affordability. But it is our assertion that the constraints that we place, both through the regulatory process and other tax SDC constraints, are creating a big problem in this state in terms of housing affordability. This bill would exacerbate that problem significantly.
May I follow up, sir?
Follow up?
Yeah, I know there's another assertion you've piled on, and I understand economic theory. The question that I have to you is, we've been operating under the 20-year supply. There's no evidence that a city will now say, we only need a six-month supply, because that would take 19 and a half years to get to a six-month supply if we already have a 20-year supply. My question is, this bill that would give local control to allow cities to figure out how to meet the problems they have and allow local communities in their own right without constraint of this 20-year model, tell me how that specifically would increase the price of housing as you started your assertion. That's what I mean, or is it just a plain assertion that has no backing? And that's okay, too, if it is. We're all entitled to our opinions.
Chair Girard, Representative Greenlick, I don't have any documentation with me this morning. But I will tell you that this bill, as I understand it, applies to cities over 25,000. Those cities have had a 20-year supply requirement since, I believe, 1995. That was created. So that 20-year requirement has only existed for a short period of time. If you remove that 20-year requirement, then you're going to find many of these larger cities will not have a 20-year supply because they won't need it. It's expensive for them to do the analysis and update their buildable lands requirements. So there won't be a 20-year supply. They won't need to go and do that. And that will create a problem because you will have a constraint on the supply of buildable land.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Harlan.
Thank you, Chair Garage.
Here from the counties, Art Schleck. Morning, Art.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And you might wonder why counties would have an interest in this bill. And the reason for that is that counties work with cities in the establishment of urban growth boundaries. And the counties and the cities have to both agree. Counties have to amend their comprehensive plans when an urban growth boundary is amended. So it is a joint process. We have looked at the bill and believe it provides additional flexibility and therefore offer at least our support for that. Many times, especially small jurisdictions, have difficulty with the requirement of a 20-year supply. And we've had a lot of discussions in the land use planning program over the last, 10, 15 years about the 20-year. Most jurisdictions have always done a 20-year supply. You start out in year one with the idea you're going to amend your comprehensive plan and update it, and you look at a 20-year supply. It takes you a couple of years to do your planning, and by the time you adopt it, you're probably into year 18 or something like that. And so there's been this ongoing discussion about is it a 20-year supply? Should you be doing a 22-year supply because of the planning process or whatever it may be? Given the two things, the flexibility, especially for small jurisdictions, and I would cite to you like St. Paul. St. Paul had some major discussions approximately 2 years ago, I believe, over this question of the mandatory 20-year supply of residential land. It finally got worked out. I don't believe it went to LUBA, but it was quite controversial with the city of St. Paul over amendments to their comprehensive plan. And, that flexibility for local government and this question about, the 20-year supply, we believe that this is a good idea and would support the passage of 2614.
Any questions for Mr. Slatt? Seeing none, thank you, Art.
Thank you.
John Chandler. Good morning, John.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler here on behalf of the Oregon Building Industry Association. I haven't actually planned on testifying on this bill this morning, but some of the comments you've heard and some of the, I just thought it might be helpful for me to provide some of the background noise on this issue, because I realize this is just labeled for a public hearing this morning, but there's going to be a number of discussions this session on the land use system, not just the 20-year component thereof or the residential component, but the whole thing. And my, again, as part of just some of the history and where we've been and where we are might help you form your judgments as the bills will come in front of you later, whether or not this one is ever scheduled for a work session or not. First thing I want to think is, I think it's important to understand, is that when the program of land use planning started in the state, 20-year land supplies was the rule of thumb that DLCD used in evaluating comprehensive plans and urban growth boundaries from the get-go. It wasn't, you know, anything particularly scientific, but that was when the bill in front of you was being amended was passed, it was simply or essentially an attempt to codify existing practice. That's what LCDC had used in reviewing the plans. That's what they'd done from the outset. And there's nothing particularly magical about 20 years. It's a number. It was a probably a whole number. Tens and fives are easier to work with mentally for me anyway than eights and sevens. It could have been 18, it could have been 17, it could have been 23. What we're trying to say with that was that there needs to be a long-range planning component. And this is important for all sorts of reasons, one of which is infrastructure provision, that if you're going to plan how a city grows, you have to know where to run the water and sewer and the roads, and those deal with big pieces of infrastructure, water plants, sewage plants, highway projects, that by their nature extend longer than a short time horizon. So if you're going to put in a series of, you know, a lot of the utilities will work on a 50-year time horizon, frankly, that, and we, you know, 20 years is a way of getting towards that long term without getting real silly about it. Frankly, anything out past a few years is just guesswork anyway. And so when we're talking about a 20-year land supply, and some of the concerns that people bring to that issue is more an extrapolation of the existing state of affairs than it is any sort of realistic knowledge about what's going to be happening in a given community in 20 years. The only reason it's on the books, I believe, was to give that time horizon for communities to say, figure out where you want to go and plan your way there in a sequential process, not that you're going to lock in any particular future. That's point one. Point two is, I think, and this is a common misconception about this issue that I've heard off and on over the years, and that is that I believe, and with all due respect to some of the folks that have testified this morning, it reverses cause and effect. The community of Monument, Oregon, out in Eastern Oregon, probably has a 20-year land supply that consists of three lots. Monument could have a 20-year land supply in their mind of several thousand acres, but that wouldn't mean they'd use up more than three lots. All a 20-year land supply, or pick your own term, you know, your own time period land supply does, is provide that whatever growth occurs can be accommodated and served and fit into the community properly. It doesn't mean that the growth will happen. And that's, I think, again, it's a cause and effect there that are important to keep in mind. Oregon has a history of planning, and we're proud of it. It's gotten in the way sometimes. It's been very beneficial sometimes. But a plan is just that. It isn't a dictate. It isn't necessarily a blueprint. It's a plan. It's setting up your expectations based on the world you see from the time you do the plan, with built-in flexibility, we hope, to adjust as circumstances change. I would submit to you that a 20-year time horizon is as good as any, and the current law we have on the books works pretty well. I think it'd be a mistake to change it to another time period or even say up to. Because again, bring me back to my first point, the issue here is to do long-range planning. And in my mind, that's a time period further than 3 or 4 or 5 or even 10 years, because of the infrastructure, because of the way communities develop, because of the investments that the people in those communities make in terms of the common areas of their community, be it schools or be it roads, goes out further. And the other point I think it's important to keep in mind is that behind a lot of the conversation about the long-range planning horizon is a fear of growth, and a fear that if you plan for it, it will happen, maybe it shouldn't happen, therefore we shouldn't plan on it. It's that kind of circular logic. like I said, the plan doesn't dictate anything in particular. It merely is the plan. And secondly, the underlying issue here, which may be worthy of legislative discussion, but I don't think you don't get there with a tweaking the number, is the issue of should growth be encouraged? Should it occur? Should we allow some jurisdictions to opt out of growth or not? Mr. Schellenberg and I have had this discussion off and on in various fora over the year, and it's kind of entertaining for both of us, I suspect, but we aren't any closer to that underlying issue. And frankly, I think there is an issue there that the state hasn't addressed. We have a system that says all communities have a 20-year land supply. We have a statute that says communities over a certain size are have to do it look more stringently than others. We've never talked as a state about what that might entail for a Canby or a Jacksonville or a Sisters or a pick your city that may or may not want to grow. Now, I think in my mind, there's a substantial difference between Burns deciding they don't want to grow and Beaverton deciding they don't want to grow in terms of the impact on the state as a whole. Having said that, again, I think right now with a 30-year land use program in front of us and not a whole lot of examination of that program over 30 years, that perhaps there are some of these questions that can be talked about. I don't think fiddling, as this bill would do, gets us to that underlying conversation. I think it's a deeper, more baseline type of an issue. And for those reasons, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would submit to you that 2614 should not be passed out of this committee. I would certainly offer my willingness to participate in future discussions about the land use system generally, the planning parts of it in particular, and how we structure our urban environments in a way to make it beneficial not only for those communities but for the state as a whole as the session goes forward. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and take any questions you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Chairman? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chandler, I think certainly it is a key question as to whether or not growth should occur, but the even more important question, I think, is who should make that determination? And what we're dealing with 2614 is whether or not there should be a greater input by the local community in making that decision as to whether or not that community should grow, or should we keep it in place and have the state be dictating an answer to that question without having the local citizens have any input on that. And certainly Jacksonville would have different issues to consider than Monument would. Of course, this is dealing with larger communities here, but I'm just interested in what your feeling is about having local control be able to make that decision by merely adding up to the 20-year rather than having it required to be 20-year.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Richardson, local control is a concept that I suspect most folks in this room would agree that local control is better than state, state's better than federal, and so on, in theory. In practice, it tends to be dictated somewhat by what the local political climate is and what it is you're hoping to accomplish within that local political climate. And so it's my way of thinking. I think there needs to be a balance, clearly, and I think one of the areas that our program is out of balance is the relationship between state and local governments as far as who calls which shots and why. But again, the underlying issue, the point I was trying to make between Burns and Beaverton, I made no disrespect to either jurisdiction. I believe intuitively that the impact on the state of Oregon is considerably different if Beaverton were to decide we are no longer going to be open for growth, for housing, for industry, for anything else, than it would be if Burns decided to. And again, I mean no slight to Burns. And I use Jacksonville as an example because I happen to love Jacksonville. And there was a fight a few years ago where Jacksonville got tortured by a bunch of folks, including me, to do their housing different. And I've always kind of felt badly about that, frankly, because Jacksonville's a beautiful community. It has a historic, I think the entire town's a historic district or close to it. But I wasn't smart enough, and I'm not sure how we do it. I wasn't smart enough to figure out how to let Jacksonville off the hook of growth or any particular type of housing or so on and so forth, and not let Lake Oswego off the hook, or not let Portland off the hook. Mm-hmm. And the site, you notice in the statutes, we have fairly gross cuts, population thresholds, at which certain things kick in, as a very blunt way of getting at that issue, that some jurisdictions have more effect on the state, and therefore the state has more interest in the goings on in those jurisdictions than others. Having said that, I think there's a discussion there. I think if I understand the question you're asking, Representative, or the thought behind the question, it's one that needs to be looked at. Because it isn't, I don't believe, cut and dried. I think local control as a baseline may work well in some cases, may not work at all in other cases. A state-run program, state dictates, no local option, may work well and sometimes may not work at all. And so the trick is to find that mix, the balance, I believe the current law has that. Now, I may have the blinders on because I worked with it so long. If there's a better way to strike that balance, I think it's worth talking about. I'm certainly worth exploring that.
Thank you. Representative Greenland.
John, I am intrigued with your notion that we pick out numbers. And I've served in capacities as a long-range planning consultant for a lot of large organizations over time. 20 years is an unusual time for a long-term plan. And what I want to ask you to consider is the issue of compounding estimates. For example, in the recent Metro debate over adding land, there was a big debate over whether the growth rate should be picked as 1.6%, as some people wanted, or the state economist's estimate, I think, of 1.4%. And that issue becomes really critical when you compound that number over 20 years. It would have been much less critical compounding that number over, say, 10 years or even 15 years. Where did 20 years come from, and did we understand the exponential growth that compounding our assumptions would make when we pick 20 instead of, say, 10?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenleg, I switch majors every time the word exponential got used, so...
I'm the
guy you want to run on numbers. And I've always been under the impression the 20-year period came from God, but I might be wrong about that. Divine inspiration, I suspect, like the rest of the land use system. It was a PFA number, pulled from there. And I was not around at the outset. My understanding, though, and there's others in the room who were because they're older than me, that in between the 50-year type horizon that a water plant might use and the 1 or 2 or 3 year horizon that we can actually extrapolate our way through and figure that it'll take that long to get a project going and all that, 20 years was kind of a blend. It was intended to get at long range but not silly, if you will, and that's a poor way of putting it. One of the things, and I think it's important to keep in mind, we're going to talk about this more with regard to the commercial industrial sector because that's where the issue has really been highlighted, and we've talked about this in the overview earlier in this committee. In looking at 20-year supplies in this state, we've done a good job. What we haven't done a particularly good job of, though, is the short-term component of that 20-year supply, which is really more critical. You know, how your community is going to look in 20 years is not nearly so important as a practical matter as what you can do next year or the year after, what you have infrastructure for, what you have money for, and so on. That, I'm not sure, I haven't thought all the way through what the implication of that is. And it gets to your question about the exponential number. In my mind, simplistically, a good planning process has a blend of short, mid, and long-range objectives, with the mid and long-range being reviewed on a periodic basis. I know 5 years is kind of the rule of thumb we use, and that may be too soon and too expensive. That's a separate conversation. But somehow making sure that if it's 1.6 when we start, and we get into it a ways and find out it's really some other number, and that takes us into, you know, the line then considerably moves one way or the other as you get further out in years, that we can adjust for that and make arrangements accordingly, either upping the land supply or decreasing service availability or whatever it might be. It is a fluid process, and the temptation for any fluid process, for at least for me, is people try to make it more concrete than it actually is or that it actually should be. And I think there's part of the concern about a 20-year supply is that the concern that it becomes mechanistic. And we had a huge argument a while back that was last session, I think the session before, Mr. Slack mentioned it. If you start the process at 20 and it takes you 2 years to get through it, then when you're done, do you have a 20-year supply or an 18-year supply, and does it matter? And at some point it turns into angels on heads of pins because you can't prove or disprove either number, and it just provides work for folks to argue with each other. I believe that the essential thing though is to be able to plan whatever time period you pick and adjust and correct and review as you go to make sure that you're operating activities are taking you towards that plan and are still on the same trajectory you thought you were, and be able to adjust as need be. If that answers your question.
I may have one more problem.
Yeah,
but if this number is pulled from air and you're here now defending it because we pulled it from air and now we've done it, the problem that I have with that is if I'm a corporation making a long-term forecast, it has some consequences in terms of short-term decisions, but not huge numbers. I mean, you keep re-looking at it. But when we make a 20-year land use, and say Metro did in this last one, it has immediate consequences.
Yes.
It changes things right now, and it changes things in a way that you can't unchange. For example, it added 500 acres of Forest Park to the urban growth boundary as a part of this 20-year decision. And once you've done that, unless we can stop
it. I was going to say, I thought Bill would have tried to unring that bell, remember?
But the point is that the 20-year prediction plus the compounding of the assumptions create consequences right now. And that's why, I think it would be very useful to allow local communities to say, well, maybe a 15-year look at it is enough for our community. And I was just wondering why, since you're saying this is a number pulled for mayor, you're now really defending that number.
Mr. Chairman, I was agreeing, like, for two reasons. Number one, pulled for mayor may be somewhat flippant. I understand that. I use it because, as I said, I'm not the guy you want running numbers. Those of us dealing with the program today inherited the 20-year from what DLCD had done. I would submit to you, though, there is not a nickel's worth of difference in reality between a 15 and a 20-year projection, because neither one of them are worth much. You can't predict the future out that far. You can plan for it. And again, my point earlier was, if the concern is that by planning for growth, somehow growth occurs, and I understand Forest Park area is a specific example of an immediate consequence. I understand the concern there, then there's a whole other conversation that can take place about why that came into the boundary instead of some other parts of the country coming into the boundary, but that's a subject for another bill or a year after work sometime. But in my mind, and perhaps it is oversimplistic from a liberal arts major standpoint, that whether the future we can see is obvious and predict for is obviously too short a time frame to be any kind of use long range. Once you get beyond that, if it's 15 or 16 or 14, and then you get into minutiae that I say is the same as the argument we had about whether an 18-year supply is as good as a 20-year or 22-year supply. It's guesswork. And the answer you get depends on the a priori you bring to the conversation and whatever background fears you have about where it might lead you in the first place. Because not only does it create immediate consequences, but also it creates immediate opportunities and immediate challenges, and in a sense, does nothing more than, if the Portland area is going, using that example, it's going to grow. And we ought to try to plan for that, whether we do so on a 20 or 15 or a 13 and a half or a 27 and a half year horizon. By the same token, if we were to take 20 years out and say up to 20 years and just leave it open, the communities can plan for any time frame they want, that might be kind of an interesting discussion. You know, should we allow jurisdictions to bring in a 50-year land supply or a 100-year land supply if they chose to? I think it'd be probably fairly dumb. But that seems, you know, 20 is a good number as any. I'm absolutely open to conversation about whether 15 is better, or pick a number and there's better. My limited number of knowledge about statistical analysis and extrapolations tells me that at some point you're just guessing and you make it somewhat more scientific by the parameters you put around it. You clearly have much more experience with it than I do.
No, it's not scientific. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to give public testimony on House Bill 2614? Burton, good morning.
Good morning, sir. Members of the committee, I'm Burton Wiest. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Wasn't obviously like everybody else planning on testifying. However, I guess I'm the old person that John was referring to in the testimony. And so I feel compelled to disagree, I guess, a little bit in Representative Greenlick's comment, which I thought was, or question, which was a good one. The number really wasn't picked out here. I disagree with that as a participant in the organization of the LCD and the program. The number really came from a couple of directions. First was that was a typical planning horizon for planning public services. And a trade-off was made, and that was, if we put a 20-year horizon, and it was in the guidelines, it was not in the goal, but it was in the guidelines for 20 years, which at the time it was written was a guideline. The guidelines have now become, in essence, rules, but it was a guideline for 20 years picked because that's what we typically planned. Water, sewer, and other public improvements were planned for 20-year periods of time. And it was also a constraint, and there was kind of a deal made. And the deal, in a sense, was, okay, you can plan for 20 years, but when you run services to the end of the urban growth boundary, you can't oversize those services for future expansion. In other words, pre-commit an expansion of the urban growth boundary by having 8-inch water lines instead of the 2-inch water lines that are provided for the what provides necessary service for the subdivision. So I hope this makes sense. The 20-year boundary was not out of thin air. It was based on what we typically planned water and sewer services for, and there was a concomitant requirement that said you couldn't oversize services at the end of the urban growth boundary. My concern is if you remove the 20-year or you somehow weaken the 20-year requirement. Our special districts provide services. Every city in the state is within a special district, including Portland. And we that provide services, if you remove that 20 years, if you keep the requirements that we can't oversize lines, you see the quandary. Public services are already expensive to provide. And if you just flat remove the 20-year requirement without looking at how services are going to be planned and provided for, then you're creating another problem. And is when we run up to the edge of the city, do we oversize the lines or not on the expectation that someday it might grow? Do we do our bond issues based on growth? Do we plan fire stations? How do we plan the location of fire stations if we don't know which direction the city is going to go in? So I'm not really advocating for or against growth. I don't really see that 20-year boundary as ever being created about growth. What that 20-year boundary was originally created for was to give us some standardized planning ability to provide sewer, water, fire services, parks, and all of those kinds of issues in the state. So 20-year boundary, we never dealt with it. We never dealt with it until the 90s, till the late 90s. Everybody had plenty of land in their urban growth boundaries. And it's only been now that we're starting to run up against it, and the 20-year line is beginning to see as a growth. And as John says, the one thing I agree with John on is it is a circular argument, which comes first, the boundary or the growth or the demand and those issues. That's fine. That's a growth issue. I agree with John. The legislature should talk about it. But don't throw out our planning tool that allows us to effectively plan for services.
Any questions of Mr. Weiss? Representative
Chair, Mr. Weiss, are you implying that local communities will just stop planning? I mean, would we willing to protect them from themselves? Is that what you're saying?
Chair Girard and Representative Richardson, I think very clearly there are communities in the state. I live in one. That if today, if there was no requirement for 20-year, well, they're going to court now to prevent any growth in their community. My concern is that if you remove the 20-year requirement, what you're going to do is you're going to make planning based on the whim of the city council of the moment. And remember what this bill does. It talks about community metro, and it talks about communities over 25,000. It's not communities don't plan in a vacuum. There's some that do. Perhaps Jacksonville does, but they're bumped up against Medford. If you take this requirement away, what you're going to do is have one city saying, we're not planning, we're not going to provide any services, we shut down today. That's a political decision made, and that can have impacts on all the communities around them. We're all kind of in this together. As districts, we often provide services for multiple cities. Chihuahua Valley Fire and Rescue provides services for 13 cities and 400,000 people. And all I'm saying is the 20-year boundary was created by the state to be a planning tool to provide for the orderly provision of services. And all I'm saying is if you remove that, you've got to start thinking about what the impacts that has. I'm not arguing for or against local control. I'm not arguing for or against growth. All I'm saying is the 20-year boundary was based on provision of services, and you've got to think about the implications of that if you remove it.
Any further questions of Mr. Weiss? Thank you, Burton.
Thank you, sir.
We have no one else left to speak on this bill. Is there anyone else who'd like to add any public testimony? Okay, we do have a possible amendment to this bill coming, so we will wait until that amendment is prepared and that entity comes forth, and we'll bring this back up at that time for a further public hearing. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2614. Committee, I will mention that today on the floor our H.A.R. 17 will have a motion on the floor today to refer the bill to Ways and Means, back to the committee, and we will, the chair and the committee, I think, agree with that move on the floor today. Okay, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2431, which is a continuance. We're going to try and honor those that were signed up to speak in the first go around that did not get an opportunity, and then we'll go to those who have signed up today. So we have number one on the list today, Bob Frank.
Representative Gerard, Vice Chair Richardson. I'm Bob Frankel, 1431 Northwest Vista Place, Corvallis. I'm here to testify in opposition to 2431 as it stands, and I've had considerable experience over the years dealing with weapons, 30 years of professional experience, and was also involved with the drafting of Senate Bill 3 then that led to the present weapons bill, which led to the present situation. I'd first like to say a few words about a couple of terms. First of all, function and values, although it was stated earlier that these were the same. They were not the same. A wetland function is what a wetland does. It protects water, for example, water quality. It might lessen floods. These are functions. Values, on the other hand, is what we think of those. For example, a farmer might value very poorly the function of increased waterfowl in the vicinity of his fields. On the other hand, the bird enthusiast might think that was just great. So values and functions are different, and you probably are more concerned in terms of being concerned about the state with issues of value, but there are functions that take place that are very important. Second term that might be confusing, the state legislation was originally drafted and does use the term maintain a stable base of wetlands representing functions. I forget quite how that phrase in the statute presently reads. That is equivalent to, but much more precise than the expression no net loss of wetlands. It really is driving the same point, but it deals with the idea of a stable base of what those wetlands do, and therefore it's a little bit more precise a statement. But there's nothing magical about that turn of words, which might be confusing. The third thing I wanted to deal with is the whole idea of mitigation. I don't think many people realize the complexity of mitigation, and particularly about mitigation banking. Mitigation banking is not just putting or buying into a franchise at McDonald's. Mitigation banking is a very deliberate process. But let's first deal with mitigation. If a developer were to come to the county and the county said, well, you may have some land that has wetlands in, and then he goes to DSL and says, well, you have to get your land surveyed, and any kind of wetlands need to be delineated. That's usually the first step in the whole process. And let's say the consultant that he hires then comes back and says, you have one third of your property is wetlands, and you'll have to get a permit to do what you want. And he goes back to DSL and says, well, I'd like to apply for a permit, and maybe starts the process. And in the process, he is required as part of mitigation to first go through the step, can you avoid doing what you want? Sometimes he can avoid some minor inconvenience. Sometimes it's a major, not just an inconvenience, but it's a major expense. But he has to be able to demonstrate that he can't do what he wants without impairing the wetland. Secondly, this next step is, can you avoid doing what you want or what you say you want? Well, often you can avoid it by moving your building maybe several hundred feet so it will not impact a wetland, or putting up a structure on pilings and things like that. But again, he has to be able to demonstrate that he looked at avoidance. Well, let's say he says there's no way I can do it without impairing the wetland. The third step is compensation. There are various ways that property can be compensated for. One is straight mitigation. Well, straight mitigation is not that straight. For example, one thing would be to prepare a mitigation plan for purchasing some of the land that's restorable and restore mitigation by restoration, by straight mitigation. Second thing that he could do in terms of compensation is to compensate by maybe enhancing one aspect of a wetland that needs some repair. That would be improving, say, the water quality aspects of that wetland. The third step that could be that he says, okay, I want to create a wetland. Well, that's another possibility. Each one of these is steps in mitigation. Then we move on to the step of a mitigation bank. The DSL coordinator says, well, of course you can buy mitigation credit from a bank. But what is a mitigation bank? A mitigation bank has been set up by someone who, and we have several of these mitigation bankers here in the room today, someone who was purchased land or owns land that had a wetland, and he is developing a bank to restore that wetland to its original state where it provides many functions. And he is guided in this by a review team. And this process is not simple. It takes often a year, which is too long, and sometimes even a year and a half. This could be shortened, but it isn't a legislative question of shortening it. DSL wants to shorten it. Everybody wants to shorten it. And it's a logistic problem, usually. That review team, together with the mitigation banker, develops a plan. The plan is reviewed. It has to be verified from a hydrology standpoint. It has to be verified from a biological standpoint. Usually the review team involves specialists. I'm on a review team right now and provide expertise from a local perspective on the wetlands in our vicinity. And then lastly, mitigation bank is approved, and the mitigation bank can begin is awarded certain credits, and then can begin to try to sell those credits. Many times, the mitigation bank takes several years, many years maybe, to sell all the credits. The value of a credit typically today is somewhere between $40,000 and $50,000. That's a lot of money. so that any plan that allows a developer, as in 2431, to buy a permit in effect and buy it at the rate of, say, $20,000, certainly is going to be getting off pretty easy. And what happens to the mitigation banker? The mitigation banker will have invested a lot of money in a mitigation bank, and everybody will have sort of shake their heads. What have we been doing all these years in this process when someone can get by that inexpensively? That's just one of the problems that I see with the legislation. I turned in my testimony, it's written out, and I spell out the concerns that I have in the legislation. I'd be glad to address any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Frankel. We have 11 other people signed up to speak this morning, so we thank you for your
time. Could I ask just one brief question? Professor Frankel, you were in the room when I asked the question of previous speakers about the issue of the value of small wetlands in private lands overall compared to the value of the Malheur National Bird Refuge or something. I mean, can you talk just a bit about the social value of maintaining this huge number of individual little wetlands compared to the big wetlands that we are so much more familiar with?
Yes. This issue comes in very indirectly, and I can't spell out the exact location of the bill right here, but it comes in when the bill says that we will adopt the federal definition, meaning the Army Corps definition of wetlands. The Army Corps definition was called into question by a Supreme Court ruling that ruled that isolated wetlands, which are not necessarily small wetlands, but are isolated hydrologically, that isolated wetlands are not covered. And the reason for the court ruling was that the basis of the ruling was through the Clean Water Act and involved the Commerce Clause, the Federal Commerce Clause, because there wasn't a interstate connection between these. On the other hand, if you could demonstrate an interstate connection, then it would hold as a valid reason for isolated wetlands. I'm not answering your question, but it's important to deal with it. This question of the definition of wetlands is under review right now by the Army Corps by the EPA. They have a review. They haven't come to a decision on this, so that anything that we do here in the state try to come in line, say, with the Army Corps really is premature. But let me address your specific question.
If you could, I'm sorry. Take just a. Can you do it in about a minute or so?
Yes.
Thank you.
Those isolated wetlands have a lot of value to stormwater reduction. They dry in the summer and the fall, and then they take the brunt of the flooding early. Once they fill up with water, you're right, they do no longer attenuate the streams. Another value of those are that they do a tremendous job in doing the purification of water. Often in agricultural regions, water is very rich in phosphates and nitrates, and they tend to denitrify, as Professor Adamus indicated, and they also tend to take up phosphates and other nutrients that otherwise would pollute water. Then, in addition to that, help filter sediments, they trap sediments, and these are done all over the place, so that when we start getting rid of them and replacing them by concrete, these adverse aspects of water quality will accumulate on the surface and move into our streams. Wildlife values are numerous, and I won't enumerate those.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Any other questions for Mr. Reinkel? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. Like some of us used to call isolated wetlands puddles.
Puddles, yeah. Big puddles. I used to walk to school over rocks in a little isolated wetland.
We're going to have to hold our testimony, if we can, for the individuals for around 3 minutes because of the length of the last testimony. So, Phil Scholes?
Good morning. My name is Phil Scholes. I am a consulting soil and water scientist. I have a company in Portland, employ about five people. My address is P.O. Box 2100, Portland, Oregon. And what I have handed out to the committee here are some proposed revisions to this bill. I think overall I want to express my support for this bill. I think that there are some things that could probably be ironed out. But I think that there's some changes that have been happening over the last week and a half in some discussions about trying to make this bill really help make mitigation banking work in the state. I think you'll hear from some mitigation bank owners later this morning that the process, it needs some changes in order to really keep the mitigation banking concept alive, which is something that the federal government has put a lot of emphasis on as of late as a solution to some of the wetland issues. What I have, I'm not going to go over all the individual things that I have proposed here. I do want to highlight just a few things which I actually highlighted on the papers handed out to you that I think are really the most critical aspects, and I guess in the spirit of compromise, if all my other changes are less important than the ones I've highlighted. Mainly on the first page, what I'd like to see, as we have been talking as wetland scientists for years about, is coming up with the methodology of how do we decide how do you replace a wetland in terms of its functional attributes, and evaluating site-specific conditions and then equating them to what do you have to do to replace them, not necessarily using some ratios that are a little bit arbitrary, but to actually come up with some kind of methodology. And I'm proposing that essentially through this process a committee be set up composed primarily of wetland scientists and faculty at the university level to sort of come up with that. I think probably the most significant change that I think is needed to this bill is at the top of the second page, which is a different part of the statute that was not really some the people that put the bill together were not aware that this one particular passage in the statute right now limits mitigation banking to sort of second choice. What it says right now is that on-site or off-site mitigation is preferred over mitigation banking. What I'm asking the committee to consider to add to this bill is essentially just put it on the same level playing field as on or off-site, so there's no particular preference. This has been a big stumbling block for mitigation banks, and it really, of all things I'm proposing as amendments, to me, that particular thing is the most important. The other things that I highlighted on here are my recommendation is that the state charge an average value for payment into their state fund of an average of all mitigation bank costs out there. So in other words, mitigation banks report to the state how much they charge, and they take an average, and that's how much you pay to the state when a mitigation bank is not available. And all we're doing here is just proposing that the cost of mitigation paid to the state be at the same market level as anyone else. Right now, it's actually significantly higher, and we're paying sometimes the equivalent of $75,000 or $100,000 an acre to go into the state fund. And it's based on property values as opposed to the cost of doing mitigation, which the mitigation banks have been proving for a number of years now. There are the other things that I have thrown in here that I think are important have to do with the wetland fill permitting process and finding a way for the state to be more efficient for them to issue permits. And in a nutshell, saying that if you have wetland impacts that are less than a half acre, that they have a standard set of conditions that they apply to them, and so that we're not spending a lot of our time discussing these little projects for, you know, 0.05 of an acre through a long 90-day process. In other words, just say, if you meet these conditions and your impacts are less than a half acre, then they would go through an abbreviated permitting process. It would save staff time at DSL. It'd save a lot of time on the applicant's side. And those standards would be something that get reviewed through a public process every 2 years. So that's a nutshell of what I've suggested there. I do want to say that I think that there are some good things within this bill, and I'd hate to see, you know, some of the people that feel strongly against this bill to just sort of throw the whole thing out instead of look for some compromises here, because I think there's some significant gains we make for mitigation banking and for the permitting process by you know, focusing on those and working for compromises on others.
Any questions of Mr. Scholes? I have one.
Yes.
I'm struggling with the definition of functional wetland functional attributes and the determination of the value of a credit. In your proposed amendment, it says basically functional attributes and credits. A credit is established by the net gain of wetland functional attributes per acre when compared to the pre-construction wetland functional attributes per acre.
What I'm trying to say there is that functional attributes is not defined anywhere, and we need to have a group of folks to actually come up with, you might say, an equation to do that. If you have a particular piece of ground that has a wetland on it, you want to be able to say, I'm impacting this particular functional attribute relating to stormwater. And maybe there's another functional attribute relating to wildlife, and maybe another one that relates to endangered species. And say that you pick it apart by each of these categories and say, if you're going to replace your stormwater function of the wetland, then this is how you must apply it on your mitigation site. And so you actually have to break it down into, you know, probably 5 or 10 different components in order to come up with what is essentially an equivalent replacement. Right now, we take the simple approach and simply say that if you impact, an acre of this wetland, then you have to do this amount of wetland based on whether it's an existing wetland, which we call enhancement, or creating a new wetland, or restoring one that was previously filled or drained. So it's getting to be more scientific. But the point is that right now, when we do wetland mitigation, we are often ending up with mitigation sites that have more function and value than what are being filled. Now, the argument can be made the other way around. There are plenty of circumstances also where the mitigation site does not replace what was lost. What we're looking for is something more scientific.
Follow up, Representative.
Are those quantifiable measures? You get something like, say, the number of cubic feet of storm water reserve, or the number of cubic feet per day of or per year of filtration. Is that what you're suggesting? That you?
Yeah, I mean, some things are very quantifiable. You can calculate with various kinds of measurements how much sediment is coming into a particular wetland and how much it's trapping and how much leaving, and then make that kind of stipulation for your mitigation site. You can do the same with stormwater. But other things are a little more vague. If you're impacting a wetland that provides geese habitat because it's a farm field and you're converting that area into a subdivision, it may be hard to sort of create another ag field wetland as mitigation. You may have to sort of horse trade for creating other kinds of wildlife habitat. And so that's where the science starts to get a little bit fuzzy. And the whole point I'm suggesting is put a committee of scientists out there and let them sort of work it out, because there's no easy solution. And across the board, the wetlands community from, you know, California to New York, you know, we're not a unified group in what methodology is the best way to do that.
It's Representative Zander Swans, I think we're talking about here now.
And having come from my particular area, the Klamath Basin, I can tell you that putting a bunch of scientists out there isn't necessarily going to solve your problem either.
I do respect that, and I guess my point is that we do have, bureaucrats that have some experience, but I think that the private sector has a lot of experience that needs to be infused in that kind of process. And so I guess I was looking for some mechanism. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, if the committee's got a better suggestion for that, go for it.
And I, of course, didn't mean to infer that all scientists don't know what they're doing.
Just
once in a while, there's one that comes along.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Scholes.
Sure, thank you.
It's becoming more obvious to the chair that it's unfair to our people who want to testify to try to limit to 3 minutes on such a important issue. So I think we're just going to have to continue this public hearing on Thursday after we take as much testimony as we can this morning. So, Mel Stewart.
Can I have the banker explain mitigation banks first?
Who's the banker that wants to explain mitigation banking?
It's for you, Matthew.
Pardon?
Richard's for you explaining mitigation.
All right, Richard, you'd like to come forward?
Yes, how does the mitigation bank work? How do you know it? How do you know it actually happens?
Since you're a banker, we'll give you a minute and a half. Just
plus
joking.
Interest.
Just joking.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I welcome the opportunity to provide some testimony on this most important issue. My name is Richard Novitsky. I represent RP Novitsky & Associates, a consulting firm in Corvallis, Oregon. I have 39 years of experience as a hydrologist. And 32 years.
Can you speak up, sir? We're having 32
years.
I'll give the mic.
Pull the mic.
32 years. Getting better?
Yeah, that's good.
32 years of those have been focused primarily on the hydrology of wetlands. At this moment in time, I am a co-sponsor involved in two of the banks here in Oregon. I've helped in various ways with many of the other banks in Oregon. And I'm also a co-sponsor of the first and so far only private entrepreneurial bank in the state of Wisconsin. We all recognize that there is going to be development, but we also recognize that we need to preserve our wetland resources. We've beaten to death the values and the functions of wetlands. And Dr. Frankel did a nice job of explaining that functions are different than values. Values is what we as a society attribute to the value of wetland. We have a system in Oregon that's working. It's not perfect by far, and it's certainly this bill has the potential for improving the system. I don't think it's flawed fatally, however, and what we would like to see is if this bill can help accomplish two objectives: to help simplify and help standardize. And the bill is certainly on the right track, attempting to simplify the way we approach this. Actually, the two primary items in the bill that I recognize as helping to simplify and standardize are both the revolving fund and the reference to mitigation banking. They will be working together. A tremendous opportunity for that to happen. The revolving fund should, however, not quite the way the previous gentleman just mentioned, it should be only available outside of areas that are presently served by banks. The banks have to get a better break in the state of Oregon. We've recognized since 1987 that mitigation banks are the best way to mitigate. It's the best tool we have in our arsenal, and they should be given even a better opportunity to be used for offsetting the impacts to wetlands, recognizing that impacts are going to happen. The payment into the fund should only occur outside of the service areas of banks, and we feel strongly that we've gone through many iterations on developing what are fair values for the impacts of to wetlands lost, and Oregon Administrative Rules 141.085.0335. Establish a fairly reasonable and workable way to develop that. What they have done is they've estimated the costs of restoration for several different classes of wetlands and then suggested adding the cost of the land in that area. It's a workable thing. It's just like the 20-year rule you were talking about earlier. It's not perfect, but it's workable. We can live with it. What we'd like to see those funds used for, however, and the bill very clearly states that they should be used for restoration, enhancement, or creation of wetlands. We would like to see those, one of the uses of those funds be to help mitigation banking in the state, provide loans to the bankers. It's very difficult for us to get a loan in acquiring the property, paying for the construction, paying for planting, paying for monitoring, when you go to your banker and say that the ROI, the return on investment, is going to be negative for at least the first 3 to 5 years. That's not a pleasant thing to say to your banker. If that could alone could happen, if those funds were available as short-term or loans to the bankers, this would be an incredible boost to mitigation banking, the private banking in the state. The other thing those funds should be used for, and it is exactly what the bill says it should be done, it should be used to buy credits from banks as soon as a bank is authorized for all those impacts that had previously been permitted by paying into the fund. This would immediately, it would help capitalize the bank, and it would immediately meet the objective of the bill, which is to use those funds to restore, create, or enhance wetland. It would be a quick and easy fix, and it would be, in my mind, the best of all things. It's a win-win situation. In terms of mitigation banking, as I said a moment ago, bank credits should be the first choice for mitigation because they are typically larger, they are typically more likely to be an ecological success, a hydrologic success, integrate into a functioning ecosystem, and they are under incredible scrutiny before the bank is authorized and for many, many years after the bank is authorized. At this moment in time, it appears as though each bank will be monitored for a minimum of 10 to 12 years. I would like, in terms of standardization, one of the largest arguments, most difficult battles in trying to arrange a bank is to develop the service area. I would like to suggest that we use something that we have been using since 1974 in this state, use the U.S. Geological Survey's 1974 Oregon State Hydrologic Unit Map, which breaks the state into approximately 100 units, which I believe is small enough for most of us to accept. The beauty of that would be the moment a banker settles on a piece of property, he would know exactly which unit he was within, and he would know what service area he would be serving. The last point I'd like to make is that this bill provides an incredible opportunity to develop a win-win situation where we can standardize, we can simplify, and make it easier for everyone, including the property owner. And if I may take one quick moment to respond to Representative Greenwich's question about isolated versus waterways wetlands. In a quick sense, the isolated wetlands allow water into them, and because they're isolated, it does not really come out. Bob pointed out that in extreme flood events, it may overflow, but in normal cases, it stays in there. So you can see that that is a more valuable function in terms of flood storage than the riverside wetland, which allows water into the wetland during the flood event and back out rather quickly as the rivers recede. So just from the flood control function alone, those are incredibly valuable resources. And to document that, in 1993, the floods on the Mississippi River were more severe than those in 1965, and yet the rainfall and the snowmelt in 1995 was less than that in 1965. The answer to that seeming dichotomy is the fact that in the ensuing 30 years, many of the isolated wetlands had been drained, and they were what caused higher flood peaks in the Mississippi drainage. So the value of isolated wetlands has been long demonstrated, and they should not be separated from waterway edge wetlands. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Any questions for Mr. Novitsky? Seeing none, thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. Now, Stuart.
David, you're the banker, and I can testify to you that it will save me plenty of time discussing mitigation banks.
Is that okay?
Yeah. Mr. Stewart?
Yep.
I'm the chairman of this committee, not you. I just want to remind you.
Okay?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dave Jampolsky. I'm the owner of Amazon Creek Mitigation Bank in Lane County. I appreciate the opportunity to give a very brief testimony. I'm not a wetland scientist, and I'm not a hydrologist. I would support this bill's goal of streamlining a process that desperately needs streamlining. I have experience in real estate development for many years, and have been in the mitigation banking business for the last 5 years. I also believe in sensible growth, and I believe in environmental protection. Mitigation banks offer an outstanding solution and tool to achieve all three of those things. I think that the bill has potential to help mitigation banks. You've heard testimony already that mitigation banking in Oregon is struggling because there's no real clear policy of when banks are going to be used to offset impacts to wetland resources. The parts of the bill that would give me pause and couldn't support would be any type of provision that would undermine mitigation banking. I mean, I heard some questions from the committee last Thursday on exactly what banking is, and I take a very simplistic approach. Mitigation banks, the three benefits, the biggest benefits, are mitigation banks are mitigation is done in advance of the impact, which is an incredibly important concept. The mitigation is already proven successful, and they also entail larger preserves, which on a national basis, these larger preserves offer more function and value often than smaller wetlands. And I think there's a difference here between these naturally occurring isolated wetlands and the smaller postage stamp type mitigation efforts that have typically occurred on site when a developer has a half acre impact and they do a half acre mitigation attempt. It does not offer the same value or functions that a much larger restoration project can offer, which is what banks do offer. Any type of in lieu fee, where fees are paid into a revolving fund or any other type of in lieu fee program, I feel is not only would undermine mitigation banking completely, but does not often translate into on the ground mitigation, that these fees go into a fund or what have you that have administrative fees and whatnot, that often does not translate to on the ground mitigation. So I think there's a real danger there of not achieving the no net loss, that there is a net loss of function and value over sometimes a very extended period of time. The benefits to the developer by a mitigation bank can be achieved. They have a known cost going into their development. It's an extreme time savings, and it also relieves them completely of their responsibility for mitigation banking. Mitigation banking basically transfers all the responsibility to the mitigation bankers. The developers don't want to be in a mitigation banking business, and we do. We've gone through the program here in Oregon, which Mr. Nowitzki had mentioned is working and is workable. It just needs support. I would say that with the appropriate amendments to this bill, that I would be very supportive of it, one of which would have to be that inside a bank's established service area, if you have an impact, that the bank would be the very first tool that is looked at, because it's the recognized best tool available to achieve your mitigation goals. Outside of that area, if there are funds received, then I do think it's appropriate to give the developer an opportunity to say this is another option, that there are no banks here, and so I can pay a fee into this fund to relieve themselves of the mitigation responsibility. But I would think it would be important to identify where those fees are going to go, and I think that support of existing mitigation banks is certainly would be desirable, and also could be kept in trust to capitalize future banks for that area. Obviously, there's not a bank in that area, and that's why the fees are going into that fund. So I think Dick pretty much said it all. Mitigation banking is a real win-win situation for the environment, and it's a win-win for developers and society as a whole. That's about all I have to say.
Any questions? Dave, what kind of, as a mitigation banker, how do you derive your fee?
Well, that's a good question. Part of the fee structure that I look at is when you have a mitigation bank and you've gone through the process, you've basically taken a piece of monoculture grass seed is field is a good example where you have hybrid soils, and historically it was a wetland, and you've restored it back to its wetland, hopefully natural state. In deriving a fee, you have obviously the cost of the land, the cost of doing the restoration, but there's also you have to look at these lands are being taken out of production now in perpetuity. We have to have a perpetual conservation, basically a conservation easement. It's not an easement, it's a protection, restrictive covenant, on the property in perpetuity. And what's that worth? I mean, if you're going to do an appraisal on the ground and you look at what it produces every year, you say, now we're going to take that, what could it have produced in over 10 years or 20 years? But perpetuity is an awful long time. So I don't think... I'm not sure if I really answered your question. I look at all three of those things, and the cost can differ from one end of the valley to the other. If you're going to create a mitigation bank in the Lane County area, and you've identified a piece of property that could be $2,500 to $3,500 an acre, whereas if you were going to do one in Portland, you'd be looking at $10,000 to $15,000 an acre, and possibly more. You'd have to take that into consideration.
Okay.
Did I answer your question? I'm sorry.
No, you didn't.
Okay. I could take another stab at it, or you can, restate it. Restate the question?
Yeah, give me the Reader's Digest. How are you compensated? Is it basically on the basis of the amount of money spent, or on the value of the credits, or...
We're compensated by selling credits to developers to offset their impacts of wetlands. I am compensated by the direct sale to developers of credits that were generated in my bank by my efforts to create the bank.
And what percentage is that?
What percentage of what, sir?
Maybe I shouldn't say percentage, but how is your how is your compensation determined? In other words, what amount of money do you make off of, let's say, a $50,000, which would be a small, but a $50,000 to $100,000 mitigation process? What would you take home out of that? Or are you talking a flat fee?
So you're talking minus the cost of my restoration, property acquisition, and creating the bank.
I'm just kind of curious because I've never been through the process, and I'm just wondering what you get out of it. What mitigation banks profit by this?
The profit margin sometimes is fairly small. It's on a percentage. I'd be uncomfortable trying to give a percentage. I've never sat down and tried to figure it out. Well, that's not true. I know what it cost me to create it. I would say... Forty percent would come home, I guess. I don't know. I think that's
it. Actually, can
in the ballpark
from bank to bank.
Yes, it can differ from bank to bank. It depends on what it costs you to obtain the land and what it costs you to do the restoration. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty in the restoration process that your restoration efforts, even in the best site in the world, may not always be successful. There's archaeological sites that can be hit that would reduce the amount of land that you're going to be able to. Produce credits from. I mean, there's a lot of variables there.
If someone were seeking a mitigation bank, they'd actually go shopping?
Well, yeah, you have to try to identify a site that's going to support what you're trying to do. And there's, not being a wetland scientist or hydrologist, I seek the advice of professionals. And, if I wanted to create a bank, is this a good site? But again, there are no guarantees that they say, yes, that's a good site, and you can have the best plan in the world, and we can go out there, and there could be a lot of different variables that could affect the outcome that you may not be successful. So bankers are at a huge risk, and personal risk at that. That's why I would also not, the in-lieu fee programs or creating a state-run bank, which is some of the things in this bill that I would think would need to be amended, where it talked about the DSL becoming basically a mitigation bank, I think is a terrible idea. There's a lot of reasons why. I mean, there's no reason for it because we already have a process that if the private entrepreneurial bankers are supported that exists now, this whole program would be successful, and you wouldn't need to have a program, a state-run program.
And are mitigation banks regulated?
Yes, heavily.
By?
We have the Corps. It's a partnership between the Corps of Engineers and the Division of State Lands, but we also have what's called a Mitigation Banking Review Team, which is about seven members, the EPA. We have, my mind's going blank here, Dick, so if you can see it, U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
I didn't mean to leave you up there all alone. I could have got Dick up here.
That's okay. I know him because I meet with him all the time. I'm just, okay. I get kind of nervous. I forget. But yes, there's seven members. So you regulate, you know, the regulation that occurs is intense. And so that, and again, that was one of the things that once you've, all these agencies have basically signed off on your mitigation because you have to have a successful project before you're allowed to sell credits. So anything less than that, I mean, on-site mitigation, off-site mitigation banking, in-lieu fees, that doesn't translate into a project that has been done in advance of the impact, that's already proven successful, and offers all of the streamlining that you want, is a program that needs to be supported. So the portions of this bill that support that are great. There are portions that would be terribly detrimental to private mitigation banking if they're not amended.
I appreciate your explanations. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You did a good job. Mel Stewart, this is your last chance.
My name is Mel Stewart. I live here in Salem, Oregon. I don't represent any group except myself. And I helped to write part of this piece of legislation. I very much appreciate your taking the time to hear this bill. Just in preface, I do want people to know that I've had a problem with DSL in their permitting system, and I've got ongoing litigation relative to that. I'm not here to talk about my permitting situation, but I just want to bring that to your attention before I go on. I don't really plan on discussing my case, as I think the broader public policy issues are more important. Giving you a little bit of history on mitigation banking, I've provided a little book.
I think we've just had that, Mr. Stewart.
Well, I was going to give you some of the legislative history, actually.
Is the committee interested?
Okay.
I think you can move on.
Okay. Any questions? Any questions? The only other thing is we met with the mitigation bankers. We actually invited the city of Eugene also. We rewrote Section 2 of the bill to accommodate their needs. I think it has language that they all strongly support. Any other questions?
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Stewart, on Section 2, the phrase assessed value is used to determine the amount payable. I'm curious as to...
We changed that in the amendments, and the amendments are under your tab 1, and we changed that to the county assessor's market value identified in the most recent property tax statement.
Do we have those amendments, Mr. Chair?
No.
Let's get it.
We do not have your amendments.
They're in the blue book under the first tab.
Well, they have to be handed to this committee.
I gave one of these blue books. I'm sorry, I didn't realize.
Well, there's an amendment process, and you haven't gone through it, but we can accommodate.
I'm sorry,
that.
I was confused on the amendment process. It's my fault.
I'm quite sure you've got them all to the committee, but you didn't do it through the committee. You probably did it individually.
I did it individually. My fault.
Okay. We should wait and have you come back when we open up more public testimony.
Okay.
In this regard, so the committee members know what the heck we're talking about.
Okay.
Just for clarification, did you go through legislative council to get an amendment, or you just sort of have an amendment there in your booklet?
I first talked to Ray, and he sent me to Bill Gerard's, and I talked to Bill's secretary, and handed him the amendments, and I thought those might be moving down to
legislative council, but I wasn't too sure about what happened to them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, there is only one proposed amendment that has been submitted to legislative council regarding this measure that went through me, and that was at the direction of the chair that I submitted that. It's not out of council yet. It'll be out probably on Thursday. But that's the only amendment that has been, that I'm aware of, that has been officially submitted.
And the amendments
change the definition of assessed value on in section 2? Do you know?
No, that's in the.
Excuse me.
Okay.
Mr. Stewart, I'll let you speak when it's time for you to speak, okay?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I don't recall. I'd have to look at the amendment to see specifically.
Well, maybe I think it's an important amendment because I was worried about assessed value being too low as a definitional term. So maybe we can just straighten it out between us a little bit later on and request an amendment.
There has been one amendment that was given to the chair that we did pass on and have LC work on. Only one amendment.
Okay.
Is all that this chair has been consulted with or asked to do. So. Okay, Mr. Stewart, proceed. Did you get your question answered?
Yes, I just want to make sure. I think this should be amended, and I take some responsibility to talk with the committee administrator to get that done.
Representative Richardson, did you have a question?
Well, I was going to ask some questions to make sure that Mr. Stewart had the opportunity to get out the information he wanted to get out.
Correct.
But since he's going to be coming back, I don't need to do that. I would like to make sure that if he has amendments that are specific and germane, that we know which ones they are, maybe we could have that now so that when he comes back, we can have had time to take a look at those.
Should I take those amendments to Ray, or what would be the to Bill's office? Or
Well, you should bring them to Mr. Kelly first, and he'll bring them to the chair to determine whether we want to allow those amendments to this bill. Okay. But I want to make sure, Mel, that you have the opportunity to speak about what you came here to speak about. But you can't speak about the amendments because you haven't prepared for the amendments properly. Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to?
I'm available for answering any questions you may have either now or later. It doesn't. Whatever.
Are there any further questions of Mr. Stewart, Mr. Representative?
Yes, Mr. Stewart, you said you had some role in drafting this, and I'm looking for the section now where certain standards were imposed upon the Court of Appeals in review of the permit process. Did you have any role in that, or did legal counsel?
Yes, I did.
Did you consult with any legal counsel before that?
Yes, I did. In fact, I included in this blue book in the last section. I've included two pages of Supreme Court decisions that were where those came from.
That's not my question. My question is, I think the point will be developed later on that there's some flaws in this draft regarding the appeals process. My question to you is, did you have legal counsel address those issues, or is this something you just created yourself from legal source documents?
Yes, I had the help of John Schunkweiler.
Okay, fine.
And it comes in, out of Dolan B. Tigard.
I'll follow up on that, thank you.
Okay. And those cases are all on the Cornell website if anybody wants to read the cases in their entirety.
Any other questions?
Can I ask a question? Yeah, I guess this is sort of two questions. You say we, and I wondered who the we is. But also as a part of that, I wonder what you see as the main problem that House Bill 2431 is the solution to.
Okay. A fairly lengthy permit process, and I've given some details about the length of the permit process, but I've given some examples, including Intel, where Intel wanted a permit, and they were held up for basically a year and a half to get a permit over a dispute. And I've given some other examples of a list of people that applied for permits, didn't get permits in a timely fashion. We reviewed 619 permits between 1995 and 2000. Of that 600...
Who's the we?
Myself, John, and Kenny, I carry my significant other.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what...
My significant other and...
Oh, okay.
And father. And what we found is that when persons submitted a permit application, they only get a permit two out of every three times. And out of that, two out of three people that get a permit, they only get a permit within a 90-day time frame, two out of three times. I.e., when you submit a permit application, your chances of getting a permit, within a 90-day time frame is about 50%. In some cases, the permit system runs on for 2 and 3 years. And just to give you an example, and I've listed this under tab two, some of the people that did not get permits that applied. And I looked at the city, the first one on the list is the City of Corvallis permit. And they applied for a permit to build a low-income housing project on city-owned land in January of 2000. They received a permit denial on 17 October 2002, about 2.5 years in process. They went through seven or eight different iterations of their permit. They incurred about $20,000 to $30,000 worth of expenses, and they came up with no permit.
I may follow up, sir.
Well,
so the purpose of the bill, as I'm looking at it, and I'm looking at these 20 or so pages of complex stuff plus some amendments I think you have, I should be prepared to vote for it if it speeds up the process, and not if it does any other, all the other things. I just have a suspicion that there's so many different objectives here, and I was trying to find out. If it's only to speed up the process, then I can understand it, and I would be interested in stripping down anything that isn't there to speed up the process. Is that?
Now, we reviewed 619 permit applications, and when we reviewed those permit applications, we went through and made a list of things that we thought were unfair, unreasonable, and we tried to address a reasonable selection of those things that we thought were the most unfair activities. So, for instance, just not giving a person a permit decision up or down. Artificially created wetland. We noticed that there was a number of permit applicants where the state of Oregon had come in and put a road in front of their property and made their property wet, or previously would not have been considered wetland. These people now had to do expensive mitigation, no fault of their own. We thought artificially created wetland was something that should be exempted under statute. We noticed it was exempted under the court statute. We noticed there were some differences between mitigation standards of the Corps of Engineers and the state of Oregon. We've adopted, in the amendments, we adopt the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers 24 December regulatory guidance letter for mitigation. So we adopt the Corps standard specifically. We think that addresses a lot of issues. So it's a laundry list. It does quite a few things, all of which I think are beneficial.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Mel, as soon as you get the amendments that you want to propose, please get them to us, and then when we have further public hearing, we'll discuss your amendments. Okay?
Thank you.
Paul Adams. Did I get the name right this time, Paul?
Yes.
Good.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I spoke last time on Paul Adams from Corvallis, Oregon, and I came back at the request of Representative Garrard. I feel that I find myself in agreement with the overall goal of trying to encourage mitigation banking here in the state, but I think regardless of some of the amendments that have been proposed or discussed, I think the bill still has several potential problems. One is it's still not clear as to whether isolated wetlands are going to be protected or not, and I feel from the scientific perspective the evidence is very strong in support of that, that isolated wetlands should continue to be protected under Oregon's wetland removal fill laws. There are other aspects of the bill that I think could lead to lots of confusion. We're kind of getting to the point now where
Yes, there had been many problems in the past with delays in permitting, the whole permitting process. But there's been some streamlining that's been done by the state agencies just in the last few months. And I see that as a real positive sign. I'm quite optimistic about it. I think by this bill including several of the provisions, I should say several of the provisions in this bill, I think could throw confusion into the whole permitting process. The permitting isn't just the state of Oregon and DSL. It's got to be done in coordination with the Corps of Engineers, EPA. And if those agencies get at loggerheads with each other, it can really mess up the whole thing. And in the end, mitigation banking would suffer. So, you know, for those reasons and the additional reason that I mentioned in my testimony the last time, I fear that this bill could, that local land use regulations might trump the removal fill. And I'm not a lawyer, but the way it's written right now, it's kind of unclear. And if that were to happen, I think it would throw even more confusion in the process. This bill, the way it is right now, is just favoring this one tool, this in lieu fee or, you know, pay for mitigation kind of approach. And I think it's better to have a bunch of tools in our tool chest, as we do now, where we can have avoidance, wetland avoidance first, minimization of damages to wetlands, potential damages secondly, and have these other tools and give them emphasis, but don't make mitigation banking and don't make this pay for the privilege of filling wetlands. Don't make those the only tools in our tool chest. And comments have also been made about functions and values. There are methods that were developed with a consensus of scientists here in Oregon, not just scientists, I should add. Many consultants were involved. These methods have not been perfected there, but there is a process that's going on currently, and I don't see the need for a bill to create a whole new process for deciding functions and values. And one final note that I'd like to close with, and that is that with wetlands, we can't use, technically, it's just not right to use a single factor to decide what are the good wetlands and the bad wetlands. We can't say, well, you know, the bad wetlands are the isolated ones and the good ones are the ones that are connected. Or the bad wetlands are the ones that are flooded for only a few days of the year, the good ones that are flooded all year round. Those kind of simplifications just don't wash with science. We've got to look at many factors: isolation, soil type, vegetation, where the wetland is situated in the landscape. Taking into account all those factors, as some of the existing functional assessment methods do, we then can come up with our reasonable judgments of which are the best functions that society, or the highest functioning wetlands that society really should focus on, and which are the lower functioning ones. So I have some additional information on wetlands from a technical perspective, just a short three-pager that I would appreciate a chance to leave with your committee. May I do so?
Certainly.
Thank you.
I had a question too, Mr. Adam. Is economic impact part of the process on wetlands?
Yes, for the Corps of Engineers, they specifically must balance economic and social concerns with the technical. And I know that because I've taught courses for the Corps of Engineers.
That's federal. It's not DSO.
That's you're talking about the Federal Corps of Engineers.
The Federal Corps of Engineers. Now, I can't speak to the DSL process. I don't know that as well as perhaps I do the federal process.
Okay. Any more questions for Mr. Adams? Thank you. I appreciate you coming back. Jim Nass. Jim, we got about 5 minutes. Do you need more time than that?
I think that's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Jim Nass, legal counsel for the appellate courts. Gosh, I feel like I've been watching the science station for 2 hours, and now we're going to give you court TV for five minutes.
Let's switch to cooking here.
We probably need some cartoons.
That I can't help you with. Most of this bill obviously addresses a topic, wetlands, that the courts have no view on one way or the other, but there are two aspects of the bill that do impact us. It's sections 10 and 11 of the bill address both judicial review of contested case hearings that come out of the Division of State Lands, and also the mandamus process to compel the director to issue a permit. Now with respect to the judicial review, and here I'm speaking to page 6 of the bill, lines 34 through 40. Frankly, when I first read this, I thought this was talking only about the hearings process, and Poison Merchant of Ackerman pointed out to me that actually, as written, the last sentence, the new sentence be added, that's being added to subsection 6, actually addresses judicial review, and it says, in any appeal of a hearings officer's final order, the director has the burden of proof to show, and it lists three things that the director would have the burden of showing. The part that doesn't make sense is that burden of proof is a phrase of art that relates to proving facts. You put on evidence in order to satisfy your burden of proving facts. And that is an appropriate function at the hearing stage. But when you're on judicial review, the record has been established, the hearing officer has found the facts, and what the role of the court is to review those facts, that is to find out, is to determine whether there is substantial evidence in the record in favor of those facts. So the provision that the director, who would be the respondent, would have a burden of proof as to facts on appeal, it doesn't fit with how the judicial review process fits, works. Now, if the sponsors of the measure meant to say that the director at the hearing would have this burden of proof, that would make more sense, and I'm certainly willing to work with the sponsors of the measure if that's what their intent was, to fix up the language there. The other two defects that we saw are a little bit more minor than that, frankly. In section 11, and here I'm looking at page 7 of the bill, at lines 38 through 41, says a decision of the circuit court under this section may be appealed only to the Court of Appeals. Now, what isn't clear to us is whether that is intended to mean that these mandamus cases will not go to LUBA, or whether that means that the Court of Appeals will be the one and only court that will review this decision, and that no one could seek review of it. So, again, here we take no position one way or the other as to what should be the proper methodology. We just want to make clear that we know what this bill is saying. And then the last item is the last sentence of that same subsection that says, in each case where the court compels the director to take an action required by statute, legal fees, if any, shall be awarded. Legal fees is not a phrase that we use in the legal field much. You either have costs or attorney fees, and it's just not clear to us which ones are meant here, and we'd just like to know what was the sponsors intent here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of Mr. Ness? Representative Ackerman.
Just a couple, then, to clarify the record. I was, I obviously understand your explanation, but maybe just to reiterate for members of the committee and the public, the burden of proof concept is consistent with the fact-finding function. Is that correct, sir?
Correct.
And the fact-finding function in this bill would be a hearing before the hearings officer itself?
Correct.
Okay. And on appeal, the court is looking at the record which has already been made, and the concept of burden of proof doesn't apply because they are not engaged in the fact-finding function.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions of Mr. Nass? Seeing none, thank you. We appreciate your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who is scheduled to speak that has a proposed amendment to this bill? Okay, I'm going to ask those that would like to amend this bill to please bring your amendments to the administrator, who will then get together with Representative Krupp, the author of this bill, to see what amendments are acceptable in his regard. And we will continue this hearing first thing on our agenda on Thursday morning. I apologize to those again who signed up and didn't get to speak, but it is one of those things I think the committee is learning. The more we get into it, the more we need to know. So thank you very much, and I will adjourn the public hearing on House Bill 2431 and adjourn the committee on environment.
Anybody that has proposed amendments with them, if you would give them to me now. Thank you. Okay, you can kill the sound.
Listen to the sound, you can holler.